Chapter 1. At first dawn, the swathes of rain drifting eastwards across the channel parted long enough to show that the chase had altered course. The Charwell had been in her wake most of the night, running 7 knots in spite of her foul bottom, and now they were not much above 1.5 miles apart. The ship ahead was turning, turning, coming up into the wind. And the silence along the frigate's decks took on a new quality as every man aboard saw her 2 rows of gun ports come into view. This was the first clear sight they'd had of her since the lookout hailed the deck in the growing darkness to report a ship hull down on the horizon 1 point on the larboard bow. She was then steering nor-east, and it was the general opinion aboard the Charwell that she was either one of a scattered French convoy or an American blockade runner hoping to reach Brest under cover of the moonless night. 2 minutes after that first hail, the Charwell set her fore and main to gallants. No great spread of canvas, but then the frigate had had a long, wearing voyage from the West Indies. 9 weeks out of sight of land, the equinoctial gales to strain her tired rigging to the breaking point, 3 days of lying to in the Bay of Biscay at its worst, and it was understandable that Captain Griffiths should wish to husband her a little. No cloud of sail, but even so she fetched the stranger's wake within a couple of hours, and at 4 bells in the morning watch the Charwell cleared for action. The drum beat to quarters, the hammocks came racing up, piling into the nettings to form bulwarks, the guns were run out, and the warm, pink, sleepy watch below had been standing to them in the cold rain ever since. 1 hour and more to chill them to the bone. Now, in the silence of this discovery, one of the crew of a gun in the waist could be heard explaining to a weak-eyed, staring little man beside him, "She's a French two-decker, mate, a 74 or an 80. We've caught a Tartar, mate." "Silence there, God damn you!" cried Captain Griffiths. "Mr. Quarles, take that man's name." Then the grey rain closed in. But at present, everyone on the crowded quarterdeck knew what lay behind that drifting, formless veil. A French ship of the line, with both her rows of gun ports open. And there was not one who had missed the slight movement of the yard that meant she was about to lay her foresail to the mast, heave to, and wait for them. The Charwell was a 32-gun, 12-pounder frigate, and if she got close enough to use the squat carronades on her quarterdeck and forecastle, as well as her long guns, she could throw a broadside weight of metal of 238 pounds. A French line-of-battle ship couldn't throw less than 960. No question of a match, therefore, and no discredit in bearing up and running for it, but for the fact that somewhere in the dim sea behind them there was their consort, the powerful 38-gun 18-pounder D. She'd lost a topmast in the last blow, which slowed her down, but she'd been well in sight at nightfall, and she'd responded to Captain Griffiths' signal to chase. For Captain Griffiths was the senior captain. The two frigates would still be heavily outgunned by the ship of the line, but there was no doubt that they could take her on. She would certainly try to keep her broadside to one of the frigates and maul her terribly, but the other could lie on her bow or her stern and rake her. A murderous fire right along the length of her decks to which she could make almost no reply. It could be done. It had been done. In 97, for example, the Indefatigable and the Amazon had destroyed a French 74. But then the Indefatigable and the Amazon carried 80 long guns between them, and the Droit de l'Homme had not been able to open her lower deck ports. The sea was running too high. There was no more than a moderate swell now. And to engage the stranger, the Charwell would have to cut her off from Brest and fight her for... for how long? "Mr. Howell?" said the captain. "Take a glass to the masthead and see what you can make of the D." The long-legged midshipman was halfway to the mizzen top before the captain had finished speaking, and his aye-aye, sir, came down through the sloping rain. A black squall swept across the ship, pelting down so thick that for a while the men on the quarter-deck could scarcely see the forecastle, and the water ran spouting from the lee scuppers. Then it was gone, and in the pale gleam of day that followed there came the hail, "On deck, sir! She's hull up on the leeward beam! She's fished her—" "Report," said the captain in a loud, toneless voice. "Pass the word for Mr. Barr." The third lieutenant came hurrying aft from his station. The wind took his rain-soaked cloak as he stepped onto the quarter-deck, and he made a convulsive gesture, one hand going towards the flapping cloth and the other towards his hat. "Take it off, sir," cried Captain Griffiths, flushing dark red. "Take it right off your head. You know Lord St. Vincent's order. You've all of you read it. You know how to salute." He snapped his mouth shut, and after a moment he said, "When does the tide turn?"
"Beg your pardon, sir," said Barr. "At 10 minutes after 8 o'clock, sir. It's almost the end of slack water now, sir, if you please."
The captain grunted and said, "Mr. Howell?"
"She's fished her main topmast, sir," said the midshipman, standing bareheaded, tall above his captain, "and has just hauled to the wind."
The captain levelled his glass at the D, whose t'gallant sails were now clear above the jagged edge of the sea. Her topsails, too, when the swell raised both the frigates high. He wiped the streaming objective glass, stared again, swung round to look at the Frenchman, snapped the telescope shut and gazed back at the distant frigate. He was alone there, leaning on the rail. Alone there on the holy starboard side of the quarter-deck. And from time to time, when they were not looking at the Frenchman or the D, the officers glanced thoughtfully at his back. The situation was still fluid. It was more a potentiality than a situation. But any decision now would crystallise it, and the moment it began to take shape, all the succeeding events would follow of themselves, moving at first with slow inevitability, and then faster and faster, never to be undone. And a decision must be made, made quickly. At the Charwell's present rate of sailing, they would be within range of the two-decker in less than 10 minutes. Yet there were so many factors. The D was no great sailer, close hauled on a wind, and the turning tide would hold her back. It was right across her course. She might have to make another tack. In half an hour, the French 36-pounders could rip the guts out of the Charwell, dismast her and carry her into Brest. The wind stood fair for Brest. Why had they seen not a single ship of the blockading squadron? They couldn't have been blown off, not with this wind. It was damned odd. Everything was damned odd, from this Frenchman's conduct onwards. The sound of gunfire would bring the squadron up. Delaying tactics. The feeling of those eyes on his back filled Captain Griffiths with rage. An unusual number of eyes, for the Charwell had several officers and a couple of civilians as passengers, one set from Gibraltar and another from Port of Spain. The fire-eating General Paget was one of them, an influential man, and another was Captain Aubrey, Lucky Jack Aubrey, who had set about a Spanish 36-gun Zeebeck frigate not long ago with the Sophie, a 14-gun brig, and had taken her. The Cacafuego. It had been the talk of the fleet some months back, and it made the decision no less difficult. Captain Aubrey was standing by the aftermost larboard carronade with a completely abstracted, non-committal look upon his face. From that place, being tall, he could see the whole situation. The rapidly, smoothly changing triangle of three ships. And close beside him stood two shorter figures. The one, Dr. Maturin, formerly his surgeon in the Sophie, and the other a man in black. Black clothes, black hat, and a streaming black cloak, who might have had intelligence agent written on his narrow forehead. Or just the word spy, there being so little room. They were talking in a language thought by some to be Latin. They were talking eagerly, and Jack Aubrey, intercepting a furious glance across the deck, leant down to whisper in his friend's ear, "Stephen, will you not go below? They'll be wanting you in the cockpit any moment now." Captain Griffiths turned from the rail, and with laboured calmness he said, "Mr. Berry, make this signal. I am about to..." At this moment, the ship of the line fired a gun, followed by three blue lights that soared and burst with a ghostly effulgence in the dawn. Before the last dropping trail of sparks had drifted away downwind, she sent up a succession of rockets, a pale, isolated Guy Fawkes Knight far out in the sea. "What the devil can she mean by that?" thought Jack Aubrey, narrowing his eyes. And the wondering murmur along the frigate's decks echoed his amazement. "On deck!" roared the lookout in the foretop. "There's a cutter pulling from under her lee!" Captain Griffith's telescope swiveled round. "Duck up!" he called. And as the clew lines plucked at the main and foresails to give him a clear view, he saw the cutter, an English cutter, sway up its yard, fill, gather speed, and come racing over the grey sea towards the frigate. "Close the cutter," he said. "Mr. Bowes, give her a gun." At last, after all these hours of frozen waiting, there came the quick orders, the careful laying of the gun, the crash of the 12-pounder, the swirl of acrid smoke eddying briefly on the wind, and the cheer of the crew as the ball skipped across the cutter's bows. An answering cheer from the cutter, a waving of hats, and the two vessels neared one another at a combined speed of 15 miles an hour. The cutter, fast and beautifully handled, certainly a smuggling craft, came to under the Charwell's lee, lost her way, and lay there as trim as a gull, rising and falling on the swell. A row of brown, knowing faces grinned up at the frigate's guns. "I'd press half a dozen prime seamen out of her in the next 2 minutes," reflected Jack, while Captain Griffiths hailed her master over the lane of sea. "Come aboard," said Captain Griffiths suspiciously. And after a few moments of backing and filling, of fending off and cries of "Handsomely now, God damn your soul," the master came up the stern ladder with a bundle under his arm. He swung easily over the taffrail, held out his hand and said, "Wish you joy of the peace, Captain." "Peace?" cried Captain Griffiths. "Yes, sir. I thought I should surprise you. They signed not 3 days since. There's not a foreign going ship has heard yet. I've got the cutter filled with the newspapers, London, Paris and country towns. All the articles, gentlemen, all the latest details," he said, looking round the quarter-deck. "Half a crown ago." There was no disbelieving him. The quarter-deck looked utterly blank. But the whispered word had flown along the deck from the radiant carronade crews, and now cheering broke out on the forecastle. In spite of the captain's automatic, "Take that man's name, Mr. Quarles," it flowed back to the mainmast and spread throughout the ship, a full-throated howl of joy. Liberty, wives and sweethearts, safety, the delights of land. And in any case, there was little real ferocity in Captain Griffith's voice. Anyone looking into his close-set eyes would have seen ecstasy in their depths. His occupation was gone, vanished in a puff of smoke. But now no one on God's earth could ever know what signal he had been about to make. And in spite of the severe control that he imposed upon his face, there was an unusual urbanity in his tone as he invited his passengers, his first lieutenant, the officer and the midshipman of the watch, to dine with him that afternoon. It is charming to see how sensible the men are. How sensible of the blessings of peace, said Stephen Maturin to the Reverend Mr. Hake, by way of civility.
Aye, the blessings of peace, oh, certainly, said the chaplain, who had no living to retire to, no private means, and who knew that the charwell would be paid off as soon as she reached Portsmouth. He walked deliberately out of the wardroom to pace the quarter-deck in a thoughtful silence, leaving Captain Aubrey and Dr. Maturin alone.
I thought he would have shown more pleasure,
observed Stephen Maturin.
It's an odd thing about you, Stephen,
said Jack Aubrey, looking at him with affection. You've been at sea quite some time now, and no one could call you a fool, but you have no more notion of a sailor's life than a babe unborn. Surely you must have noticed how glum Quarles and Rogers and all the rest were at dinner, and how blue everyone's always looked this war when there was any danger of peace.
I put it down to the anxieties of the night, the long strain, the watchfulness, the lack of sleep.
I must not say the apprehension of danger. Captain Griffiths was in a fine flow of spirits, however.
Oh, said Jack, closing one eye, that was rather different. And in any case, he's a post-captain, of course. He has his 10 shillings a day, and whatever happens, he goes up the captain's list as the old ones die off or get their flag. He's quite old, 40, I dare say, or even more, but with any luck he'll die an admiral. No, it's the others I'm sorry for, the lieutenants with their half-pay and very little chance of a ship. None at all of promotion. The poor, wretched midshipmen who have not been made and who never will be made now. No hope of a commission. And, of course, no half-pay at all. It's the merchant service for them or blacking shoes outside St. James's Park. Haven't you heard the old song? I'll tip you a stave. He hummed the tune, and in a discreet rumble he sang. Says Jack, there is very good news. There is peace both by land and by sea. Great guns no more shall be used, for we all disbanded be. Says the admiral, that's very bad news. Says the captain, my heart will break. The lieutenant cries, what shall I do? For I know not what course for to take. Says the doctor, I'm a gentleman too. I'm a gentleman of the first rank. I will go to some country fair, and there I'll set up mountebank.
That's for you, Stephen. Says the midshipman, I have no trade. I have got my trade for to choose. I will go to St. James's Park Gate, and there I'll set black of shoes. And there I will set all day at everybody's call. And everyone that comes by, do you want my nice shining balls?
Mr. Quarles looked in at the door, recognised the tune, and drew in a sharp breath. But Jack was a guest, a superior officer, a master and commander, no less, with an epaulette on his shoulder, and he was broad as well as tall. Mr. Quarles let his breath out in a sigh and closed the door.
I should have sung softer,
said Jack, and drawing his chair closer to the table, he went on in a low voice,
Nah, those are the chaps I'm sorry for.
I'm sorry for myself, too, naturally. No great likelihood of a ship, and, of course, no enemy to cruise against if I do get one, but it's nothing in comparison of them. We've had luck with prize money, and if only it were not for this infernal delay over making me post, I should be perfectly happy to have a 6 months' run ashore. Hunting, hearing some decent music, the opera. We might even go to Vienna, eh? What do you say, Stephen? Though I must confess this slowness irks my heart and soul. However, it's nothing in comparison of them, and I make no doubt it'll be settled directly. He picked up the Times and ran through the London Gazette in case he should have missed his own name in the first three readings. "Toss me the one in the locker, will you?" he said, throwing it down. "The Sussex Courier."
"This is more like it, Stephen," he said 5 minutes later. "Mr. Savile's hounds will meet at 10 o'clock on Wednesday the 6th of November, 1802, at Champflower Cross. I had such a run with them when I was a boy. My father's regiment was in camp at Rainsford, a 7 mile point, prodigious fine country if you have a horse that can really go. Oh, listen to this. A neat gentleman's residence standing upon gravel is to be let by the year at moderate terms. Stabling for 10, it says.
Are there any rooms?
Well, of course there are. It couldn't be called a neat gentleman's residence without there were rooms. What a fellow you are, Stephen. 10 bedrooms. By God, there's a lot to be said for a house not too far from the sea in that sort of country.
Had you not thought of going to Woolhampton, of going to your father's house?
Yes, yes, I mean to give him a visit, of course, but there's my new mother-in-law, you know. And to tell you the truth, I don't think it would exactly answer.
He paused, trying to remember the name of the person, the classical person, who had had such a trying time with his father's second wife. For General Aubrey had recently married his dairymaid, a fine, black-eyed young woman with a moist palm whom Jack knew very well. Actaeon? Ajax? Aristides? He felt that their cases were much alike and that by naming him he would give a subtle hint of the position, but the name wouldn't come. And after a while he reverted to the advertisements. There's a great deal to be said for somewhere in the neighbourhood of Rainsford, 3 or 4 packs within reach, London only a day's ride away, and neat gentlemen's residences by the dozen, all standing upon gravel. You'll go snacks with me, Stephen. We'll take Bondon, Killick, Lewis, and perhaps one or two other old sophies, and ask some of the youngsters to come and stay. We'll lay in beer and skittles. It'll be Fiddler's Green.
I should like it of all things, said Stephen. Whatever the advertisements may say, it is a chalk soil, and there are some very curious plants and beetles on the downs. I am with child to see a dew pond.
Polkerry Down, and the cold sky over it. A searching air from the north, breathing over the water meadows, up across the plough, up and up to this great sweep of open turf, the down, with the covert called Rumbold's Gorse sprawling on the lower edge of it. A score of red-coated figures dotted round the gorse, and far away below them on the middle slope, a ploughman standing at the end of his furrow, motionless behind his team of Sussex oxen, gazing up as Mr. Savile's hounds worked their way through the furze and the brown remnants of the bracken. Slow work, uncertain patchy scent, and the fox hunters had plenty of time to drink from their flasks, blow on their hands, and look out over the landscape below them. The river, winding through its patchwork of fields, the towers or steeples of Hither, Middle, Nether and Savile Champflower, the 6 or 7 big houses scattered along the valley, the whaleback downs one behind the other, and far away the lead-coloured sea. It was a small field, and almost everyone there knew everyone else. Half a dozen farmers, some private gentlemen from the Champflowers and the outlying parishes, 2 militia officers from the dwindling camp at Rainsford, Mr. Burton, who had come out in spite of his streaming cold in the hope of catching a glimpse of Mrs. St. John and Dr. Vining, with his hat pinned to his wig and both tied under his chin with a handkerchief. He had been led astray early in his rounds. He couldn't resist the sound of the horn, and his conscience had been troubling him ever since the scent had faded and died. From time to time he looked over the miles of frigid air between the covert and Mapes Court, where Mrs. Williams was waiting for him. "There is nothing wrong with her," he observed. "My physic will do no good. But in Christian decency I should call, and indeed I shall, unless they find again before I can tell 100. He put his finger upon his pulse and began to count. At 90 he paused, looking about for some reprieve, and on the far side of the covert he saw a figure he didn't know. "That is the medical man they've been telling me about, no doubt," he said. "It would be a civil thing to go over and say a word to him. A rum-looking cove. Dear me, a very rum-looking cove." The rum-looking cove was sprawling upon a mule, an unusual sight in an English hunting field. And quite apart from the mule, there was a strange air about him. His slate-coloured small clothes, his pale face, his pale eyes, and even paler close-cropped skull. His hat and wig were tied to his saddle, and the way he bit into a hunk of bread rubbed with garlic. He was calling out in a loud tone to his companion, in whom Dr. Vining recognised the new tenant of Melbury Lodge. "I tell you what it is, Jack," he was saying. "I tell you what it is. You, sir! You on the mule!" cried old Mr. Savile's furious voice. "Will you let the goddamn dogs get on with their work, hey, hey? Is this a goddamn coffee house? I appeal to you, is this an infernal debating society?" Captain Aubrey pursed his lips demurely and pushed his horse over the 20 yards that separated them. "Tell me later, Stephen," he said in a low voice, leading his friend round the covert out of the master's sight. "Tell me later when they've found their fox." The demure look didn't sit naturally upon Jack Aubrey's face, which, in this weather, was as red as his coat, and as soon as they were round the corner, under the lee of a wind-blown thorn, his usual expectant cheerfulness returned, and he looked eagerly up into the firs, where an occasional heave and rustle showed the pack in motion. "Looking for a fox, are they?" said Stephen Matchalin, as though hippogriffs were the more usual quarry in England, and he relapsed into a brown study, munching slowly upon his bread. The wind breathed up the long hillside. Remote clouds passed evenly across the sky. Now and then Jack's big hunter brought his ears to bear. This was a recent purchase, a strongly built bay, quite up to Jack's 16 stone. But it didn't much care for hunting, and then, like so many geldings, it spent much of its time mourning for its lost stones, a discontented horse. If the moods that succeeded one another in its head had taken the form of words, they would have run, "Too heavy. Sits too far forward when we go over a fence. I've carried him far enough for one day. Shall have him off presently, see if I don't. I smell a mare, a mare! Oh!" Its flaring nostrils quivered, and it stamped. Looking round, Jack saw that there were newcomers in the field. A young woman and a groom came hurrying up the side of the plough, the groom mounted on a cob and the young woman on a pretty little high-bred chestnut mare. When they reached the post and rail dividing the field from the down, the groom cantered on to open a gate, but the girl set her horse at the rail and skipped neatly over it. Just as a whimpering and then a bellowing roar inside the covert gave promise of great things. The noise died away. A young hound came out and stared into the open. Stephen Matchalin moved from behind the close-woven thorn to follow the flight of a falcon overhead
and at the sight of the mule the chestnut mare began to caper, flashing her white stockings and tossing her head.
"Get over, you bastard," said the girl in her pure, clear young voice.
Jack had never heard a girl say bastard before, and he turned to look at her with a particular interest. She was busy coping with the mare's excitement, but after a moment she caught his eye and frowned. He looked away, smiling, for she was the prettiest thing. Indeed, beautiful, with her heightened colour and her fine, straight back, sitting a horse with the unconscious grace of a midshipman at the tiller in a lively sea. She had black hair and blue eyes, a certain ram-you-damn-you air that was slightly comic and more than a little touching in so slim a creature. She was wearing a shabby blue habit with white cuffs and lapels, like a naval lieutenant's coat, and on top of it all, a dashing tricorn with a tight curl of ostrich feather. In some ingenious way, probably by the use of combs, she had drawn up her hair under this hat so as to leave one ear exposed. And this perfect ear, as Jack observed when the mare came crab-wise towards him, was as pink as... "There's that fox of theirs," remarked Stephen in a conversational tone.
"There's that fox we hear so much about, though indeed it is a vixen, sure."
Slipping quickly along a fold in the ground, the leaf-coloured fox went slanting down across them towards the plough. The horse's ears and the mule's followed it, cocked like so many semaphores. When the fox was well clear, Jack rose in his stirrups, held up his hat, and hollered it away in a high sea's roar that brought the huntsman tearing round, his horn going twang, 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 and hounds racing from the firs at all points. They hit the scent in the sheltered hollow, and they were away with a splendid cry. They poured through the fence. They were halfway across the unploughed stubble, a close-packed body, such music, and the huntsman was right up there with them. The field came thundering round the covert, someone had the gate open, and in a moment there was an eager crowd jostling to get through, for it was a devilish unpleasant downhill leap just here. Jack held hard, not choosing to thrust his first time out in a strange country, but his heart was beating to quarters double time, and he had already worked out the line he would follow once the press had thinned. Jack was the keenest of fox hunters. He loved everything about the chase, from the first sound of the horn to the rancid smell of the torn fox. But in spite of a few unwelcome spells without a ship, he had spent two-thirds of his life at sea. His skill was not all he thought it was. The gate was still jammed. There would be no chance of getting through it before the pack was in the next field. Jack wheeled his horse, called out, "Come on, Stephen!" and put it at the rail. Out of the corner of his eye he saw the chestnut flash between his friend and the crowd in the gate. As his horse rose, Jack screwed round to see how the girl would get over, and the gelding instantly felt this change of balance. It took the rail flying high and fast, landed with its head low, and with a cunning twist of its shoulder and an upward thrust from behind, it unseated its rider. He didn't fall at once. It was a slow, ignominious glide down that slippery near shoulder, with a fistful of mane in his right hand. But the horse was the master of the situation now, and in 20 yards the saddle was empty. The horse's satisfaction didn't last, however. Jack's boot was wedged in his near stirrup. It wouldn't come free. And here was his heavy person jerking and thumping along at the gelding's side, roaring and swearing horribly. The horse began to grow alarmed, to lose its head, to snort, to stare wildly, and to run faster and faster across those dark, flint-strewn, unforgiving furrows. The ploughman left his oxen and came lumbering up the hill, waving his goad.
A tall young man in a green coat, a foot follower, called out, "Whoa there! Whoa there!" and ran towards the horse with his arms spread wide. The mule, the last of the vanishing field, turned and raced back to cut the gelding off, swarming along in its inhuman way very close to the ground. It outran the men, crossed the gelding's path, stood firm, and took the shock. Like a hero, Stephen flung himself off, seized the reins, and clung there until Greencoat and the ploughman came pounding up. The oxen, left staring halfway along their furrow, were so moved by all this excitement that they came very nearly to the point of cutting a caper on their own. But before they'd made up their minds, it was over. The ploughman was leading the shame-faced horse to the side of the field, while the other two propped Raw Bones and Bloody Head between them, listening gravely to his explanations. The mule walked behind. Mapes Court was an entirely feminine household. Not a man in it, apart from the butler and the groom. Mrs. Williams was a woman, in the natural course of things, but she was a woman so emphatically, so totally a woman, that she was almost devoid of any private character. A vulgar woman, too, although her family, which was of some importance in the neighbourhood, had been settled there since Dutch William's time. It was difficult to see any connection, any family likeness, between her and her daughters and her niece, who made up the rest of the family. Indeed, it wasn't much of a house for family likeness. The dim portraits might have been bought at various auctions. And although the three daughters had been brought up together with the same people around them in the same atmosphere of genteel money worship, position worship, and suffused indignation, an indignation that did not require any object for its existence, but that could always find one in a short space of time. The housemaid wearing silver buckles on Sunday would bring on a full week's flow. They were as different in their minds as they were in their looks. Sophia, the eldest, was a tall girl, with wide-set grey eyes, a broad, smooth forehead, and a wonderful sweetness of expression. Soft, fair hair, inclining to gold, and exquisite skin. She was a reserved creature, living much in an inward dream whose nature she did not communicate to anyone. Perhaps it was her mother's unprincipled rectitude that had given her this early disgust for adult life. But whether or no, she seemed very young for her 27 years. There was nothing in the least degree affected or kittenish about this. Rather a kind of ethereal quality. The quality of a sacrificial object. Iphigenia before the letter. Her looks were very much admired. She was always elegant, and when she was in look, she was quite lovely. She spoke little in company or out, but she was capable of a sudden dart of sharpness, of a remark that showed much more intelligence and reflection than would have been expected from her rudimentary education and her very quiet provincial life. These remarks had a much greater force coming from an amiable, pliant, and, as it were, sleepy reserve. And before now they had startled men who didn't know her well, men who had been prating away happily with the conscious superiority of their sex. They dimly grasped an underlying strength, and they connected it with her occasional expression of secret amusement, the relish of something that she did not choose to share. Cecilia was more nearly her mother's daughter, a little goose with a round face and china-blue eyes, devoted to ornament and to crimping her yellow hair, shallow and foolish almost to simplicity, but happy, full of cheerful noise, and not yet at all ill-natured. She dearly loved the company of men, men of any size or shape. Her younger sister Frances did not,
She was indifferent to their admiration. A long-legged nymph, still given to whistling and shying stones at the squirrels in the walnut tree. Here was all the pitilessness of youth intact. And she was perfectly entrancing as a spectacle. She had her cousin Diana's black hair and great dark blue misty pools of eyes, but she was as unlike her sisters as though they belonged to another sex. All they had in common was youthful grace, a good deal of gaiety, splendid health, and £10,000 apiece. With these attractions, it was strange that none of them should have married, particularly as the marriage bed was never far from Mrs. Williams' mind. But the paucity of men, of eligible bachelors in the neighbourhood, the disrupting effects of 10 years of war, and Sophia's reluctance, she had had several offers, explained a great deal. The rest could be accounted for by Mrs. Williams' avidity for a good marriage settlement, and by an unwillingness on the part of the local gentleman to have her as a mother-in-law. Whether Mrs. Williams liked her daughters at all was doubtful. She loved them, of course, and had sacrificed everything for them. But there wasn't much room in her composition for liking. It was too much taken up with being right. "Hast thou considered, my servant Mrs. Williams, that there is none like her in the earth, a perfect and an upright woman, with being tired and with being ill-used?" Dr. Vining, who had known her all her life and who had seen her children into the world, said that she did not. But even he, who cordially disliked her, admitted that she truly, wholeheartedly loved their interest. She might damp all their enthusiasms, drizzle grey disapproval from one year's end to the next, and spoil even birthdays with bravely supported headaches, but she would fight parents, trustees, and lawyers like a tigress for an adequate provision. Yet still she had 3 unmarried daughters. And it was something of a comfort to her to be able to attribute this to their being overshadowed by their niece. Indeed, this niece, Diana Villiers, was as good-looking in her way as Sophia. But how unlike these 2 ways were. Diana, with her straight back and high-held head, seemed quite tall. But when she stood next to her cousin, she came no higher than her ear. They both had natural grace in an eminent degree, but whereas Sophia's was a willowy, almost languorous, flowing perfection of movement, Diana's had a quick, flashing rhythm. On those rare occasions when there was a ball within 20 miles of Mapes, she danced superbly. And by candlelight her complexion was almost as good as Sophia's. Mrs. Villiers was a widow. She had been born in the same year as Sophia, but what a different life she had led. At 15, after her mother's death, she had gone out to India to keep house for her expensive, raffish father, and she had lived there in splendid style even after her marriage to a penniless young man, her father's aide-de-camp, for he had moved into their rambling great palace where the addition of a husband and an extra score of servants passed unnoticed. It had been a foolish marriage on the emotional plane, both too passionate, strong, self-willed, and opposed in every way to do anything but tear one another to pieces. But from the worldly point of view, there was a great deal to be said for it. It did bring her a handsome husband, and it might have brought her a deer park and 10,000 a year as well, for not only was Charles Villiers well connected, one sickly life between him and a great estate, but he was intelligent, cultivated, unscrupulous, and active, particularly gifted on the political side, the very man to make a brilliant career in India. A second Clive, maybe, and wealthy by the age of 30-odd. but they were both killed in the same engagement against Tipu Sahib. Her father owing 3 lakhs of rupees, and her husband nearly half that sum. The company allowed Diana her passage home and £50 a year until she should remarry. She came back to England with a wardrobe of tropical clothes, a certain knowledge of the world, and almost nothing else. She came back, in effect, to the schoolroom, or something very like it. For she at once realised that her aunt meant to clamp down on her, to allow her no chance of queering her daughter's pitch. And as she had no money and nowhere else to go, she determined to fit into this small, slow world of the English countryside, with its fixed notions and its strange morality. She was willing, she was obliged, to accept a protectorate. And from the beginning she resolved to be meek, cautious, and retiring. She knew that other women would regard her as a menace, and she meant to give them no provocation. But her theory and her practice were sometimes at odds. And in any case, Mrs. Williams' idea of a protectorate was much more like a total annexation. She was afraid of Diana and dared not push her too far, but she never gave up trying to gain a moral superiority. And it was striking to see how this essentially stupid woman, unhampered by any principle or by any sense of honour, managed to plant her needle where it hurt most. This had been going on for years. And Diana's clandestine, or at least unavowed, excursions with Mr. Savile's hounds had a purpose beyond satisfying her delight in riding. Returning now, she met her cousin Cecilia in the hall, hurrying to look at her new bonnet in the pier glass between the breakfast-room windows. "Thou look'st like Antichrist in that lewd hat," she said in a sombre voice, for the hounds had lost their fox, and the only tolerable-looking man had vanished.
"Oh! Oh!" cried Cecilia. "What a shocking thing to say! It's blasphemy, I'm sure. I declare I've never had such a shocking thing said to me since Jemmy Blagrove called me that rude word. I shall tell Mama."
"Don't be a fool, Sissy. It's a quotation. Literature. The Bible."
"Oh. Well, I think it's very shocking. You're covered with mud, Di. Oh, you took my tricorner. What an ill-natured thing you are. I'm sure you spoilt the feather. I shall tell Mama." She snatched the hat, but finding it unhurt, she softened and went on. "Well, and so you had a dirty ride. You went along Gallipot Lane, I suppose. Did you see anything of the hunt? They were over there on Polkerry all the morning with their horrid howling and yowling."
"I saw them in the distance," said Diana.
"You frightened me so with that dreadful thing you said about Jesus,"
said Cecilia, blowing on the ostrich feather,
"that I almost forgot the news. The Admiral's back."
"Back already?"
"Yes, and he'll be over this very afternoon. He sent Ned with his compliments, and might he come with Mama's Berlin wool after dinner. Such fun! He'll tell us all about these beautiful young men. Men, Diana!"
The family had scarcely gathered about their tea before Admiral Haddock walked in. He was only a yellow admiral, retired without hoisting his flag, and he hadn't been afloat since 1794, but he was their one authority on naval matters, and he'd been sadly missed ever since the unexpected arrival of a Captain Aubrey of the Navy, a captain who had taken Melbury Lodge and who was therefore within their sphere of influence, but about whom they knew nothing and upon whom, he being a bachelor, they, as ladies, could not call.
"Pray, Admiral,"
said Mrs. Williams,
as soon as the Berlin Wool had been faintly praised, peered at with narrowed eyes and pursed lips, and privately condemned as useless, nothing like a match in quality, colour or price.
Pray, Admiral, tell us about this Captain Aubrey, who they say has taken Melbury Lodge.
Oh, Aubrey! Oh, yes,
said the Admiral, running his dry tongue over his dry lips like a parrot.
I know all about him. I've not met him, but I talked about him to people at the club and in the Admiralty, and when I came home I looked him up in the Navy list. He's a young fellow, only a master and commander, you know.
Do you mean he's pretending to be a captain?
Cried Mrs. Williams, perfectly willing to believe it.
No, no, said Admiral Haddock impatiently. We always call commanders captains so-and-so in the Navy. Real captains, full captains, we call post-captains. We say a man is made post when he's appointed to a sixth-rate or better, an 8-20, say, or a 32-gun frigate. A post-ship, my dear madam.
Oh, indeed,
said Mrs. Williams, nodding her head and looking wise.
Only a commander, but he did most uncommon well in the Mediterranean. Lord Keith gave him cruise after cruise in that little old quarter-deck brig we took from the Spaniards in 95, and he played old Harry with the shipping up and down the coast. There were times when he well-nigh filled the Lazaretto Reach in Mahon with his prizes. Lucky Jack Aubrey, they called him. He must have cleared a pretty penny, a most elegant penny indeed. And he it was who took the Cacafuego, the very man, said the Admiral with some triumph, gazing round the circle of blank faces.
After a moment's pause of unbroken stupidity on their part, he shook his head, saying,
You've never even heard of the engagement, I collect.
No, they had not. They were sorry to say that they had not heard of the Cacafuego. Was it the same as the Battle of St. Vincent? Perhaps it had happened when they were so busy with the strawberries. They'd put up 200 pots.
Well, the Cacafuego was a Spanish Zeebeck frigate of 32 guns, and he went for her in his little 14-gun sloop, fought her to a standstill, and carried her into Menorca. Such an action! The service rang with it. And if it hadn't been for some legal quirk about her papers, she being lent to the Barcelona merchants and not commanded by her regular captain, which meant that technically she was not for the moment a kingship but a privateer, he would have been made post and given command of her, perhaps knighted too. But as it was, there being wheels within wheels, as I will explain at another time, for it's not really suitable for young ladies, she was not brought into the service. And so far he's not been given his step. What is more, I don't think he ever will be. He's a vile, ranting dog of a Tory, to be sure, or at least his father is, but even so it was shameful. He may not be quite the thing, but I intend to take particular notice of him. Shall call tomorrow to mark my sense of the action and of the injustice.
So he's not quite the thing, sir? Asked Cecilia.
Why, no, my dear, he's not. Not at all the thing, they tell me. Dashing he may be, indeed he is. But discipline? Pah! That's the trouble with so many of your young fellows, and it'll never do in the service. It'll never do for St. Vincent. Many complaints about his lack of discipline, independence, disobeying orders. No future in the service for that kind of officer. Above all, with St. Vincent at the Admiralty. And that I fear he may not attend to the fifth commandment quite as he should.
The girls' faces took on an inward look as they privately ran over the decalogue. In order of intelligence, a little frown appeared on each as its owner reached the part about Sunday travelling, and then cleared as they carried on to the commandment the Admiral had certainly intended.
There was a great deal of talk about about a superior officer's wife, and they say that was at the bottom of the matter. A sad rake, I fear, and undisciplined, which is far worse. You may say what you please about old Jarvie, but he'll not brook undisciplined conduct. And he doesn't love a Tory, either.
Is old Jarvie a naval word for the evil one, sir?
Asked Cecilia. The Admiral rubbed his hands.
He's Earl St. Vincent, my dear, the First Lord of the Admiralty.
At the mention of authority, Mrs. Williams looked grave and respectful. and after a reverent pause she said,
"I believe you mentioned Captain Aubrey's father, Admiral?"
"Yes. He's that General Aubrey who made such a din by flogging the Whig candidate at Hinton."
"How very disgraceful.
But surely to flog a Member of Parliament, he must be a man of considerable estate."
"Only moderate, ma'am. The moderate little place the other side of Woolhampton. And much encumbered, they tell me. My cousin Hammer knows him well."
"And is Captain Aubrey the only son?"
"Yes, ma'am. Though, by the by, he has a new mother-in-law. The General married a girl from the village some months ago. She's said to be a fine, sprightly young woman."
"Good heavens, how wicked!"
said Mrs. Williams. "But I presume there's no danger, and I presume the General is of a certain age."
"Not at all, ma'am," said the Admiral. "He can't be much more than 65. Were I in Captain Aubrey's shoes, I should be most uneasy."
Mrs. Williams brightened. "Poor young man," she said placidly.
"I quite feel for him, I protest."
The butler carried away the tea tray, mended the fire, and began to light the candles.
"How the evenings are drawing in," said Mrs. Williams.
"Never mind the sconces by the door. Pull the curtains by the cord, John. Touching the cloth wears it so, and it's bad for the rings. And now, Admiral, what have you to tell us of the other gentleman at Melbury Lodge, Captain Aubrey's particular friend?"
"Oh, him," said Admiral Haddock. "I don't know much about him. He was Captain Aubrey's surgeon in this sloop, and I believe I heard he was someone's natural son. His name's Maturin."
"If you please, sir," said Francis, "what is a natural son?"
"Why," said the Admiral, looking from side to side,
"are sons more natural than daughters, pray?"
"Hush, my dear," said Mrs. Williams.
"Mr. Lever called at Melbury," said Cecilia. "Captain Aubrey had gone to London. He's always going to London, it appears. But he saw Dr. Maturin and says that he's quite strange, quite like a foreign gentleman. He was cutting up a horse in the winter drawing-room."
"How very undesirable," said Mrs. Williams. "They'll have to use cold water for the blood. Cold water's the only thing for the marks of blood. Do not you think, Admiral, that they should be told they must use cold water for the marks of blood?"
"I dare say they're tolerably used to getting rid of stains of that kind, ma'am," said the Admiral. "But now I come to think of it," he went on, gazing round the room, "what a capital thing it is for you girls to have a couple of sailors with their pockets full of guineas turned ashore and pitched down on your very doorstep. Anyone in want of a husband has but to whistle and they'll come running."
The Admiral's sally had a wretched reception. Not one of the young ladies joined in his mirth. Sophia and Diana looked grave, Cecilia tossed her head, Francis scowled, and Mrs. Williams pursed up her mouth, looked down her nose, and meditated a sharp retort.
"However,"
he continued, wondering at the sudden chill in the room,
"it's no go, no go at all, now that I recollect. He told Trimble, who suggested a match with his sister-in-law, that he had quite given up women. It seems that he was so unfortunate in his last attachment that he's quite given up women. And indeed he is an unlucky wight, whatever they may call him. There's not only this wretched business of his promotion and his father's cursed untimely marriage, but he also has a couple of neutral prizes in the Admiralty Court on appeal. I dare say that's why he's perpetually fagging up and down to London. He's an unlucky man, no doubt. And no doubt he's come to understand it. So he has very rightly given up all thoughts of marriage, in which luck is everything. He's quite given up women."
"It is perfectly true," cried Cecilia. "There is not a single woman in the house. Mrs. Burdett, who just happened to be passing by, and our Molly, whose father's cottage is directly behind and can see everything, say there is not a woman in the house. There they live together with a parcel of sailors to look after them. La, how strange! And yet Mrs. Burdett, who had a good look, you may be sure,
says the window panes were shining like diamonds and all the frames and doors had been new painted white.
How can they hope to manage?
Asked Mrs. Williams.
Surely it's very wrong-headed and unnatural. Dear me, I shouldn't fancy sitting down in that house. I should wipe my chair with my handkerchief, I can tell you.
Why, ma'am, cried the Admiral, we manage tolerably well at sea, you know.
At sea,
said Mrs. Williams with a smile.
What can they do for mending, poor things?
Asked Sophia.
I suppose they buy new.
I can just see them with their stockings out at heel, cried Francis with a coarse whoop, pegging away with their needles. Doctor, may I trouble you for the blue worsted? After you with the thimble, if you please.
I dare say they can cook, said Diana. Men can broil a steak, and there are always eggs and bread and butter. But how wonderfully strange, cried Cecilia. How romantic, as good as a ruin. Oh, I long to see them.